everybody. Welcome to Let's Talk About Thrones with your hosts, Sir Anthony of Winterfell, Sir Richard of River Run, even though he doesn't know what that means, and Jenny of Tarth. This is a show where we do something that no one else on the internet has ever done, which is recap a TV show that we've all, most of us, already seen, and have a little fun with it. And if the title of this show seems somewhat familiar, it's because one of us, and I'm not going to say who, is also on a show called Let's Talk About Star Wars with two other fine gentlemen of the internet. And so those fine gentlemen have kindly agreed to let us become a franchise. So welcome to the Let's Talk About Thrones episode one. What do you guys think?
That's got to be the title right there. Episode one?
One? I hope you guys are doing well today.
Indeed.
It's a glorious day here in King's Landing.
Is that where we are right now?
We're in King's Landing? Oh, sure. I don't know.
The waves are crashing upon the shore. The knights are mounting the parapets.
And all the ladies are swimming in the river. I just read that actually again. So each of us is going to, if you didn't get this by now, we're all watching Game of Thrones. Sir Anthony and I are watching it again. Sir Richard is watching it for the very first time. So he has no idea what a Sarah is. He doesn't know where River Run is. And half the things we're going to say are going to be confusing, and the other half are going to be coded spoilers. So sorry in advance. I'm going to say that every episode. Now, that's Richard.
Anthony, wait. You are apologizing for my contribution?
No, I'm apologizing for how much we're going to ruin your experience of this show.
Well, I think the intent is you're going to try not to.
Try. There is no try. We're going to ruin it. Wrong show.
Yeah, something is bound to slip out eventually.
I was already thinking through what we're going to do here, and I was thinking, how am I going to say these things without totally ruining Richard's good time? So for those of you who have seen the series before, you will enjoy our attempt at coded references, and the rest of you will be confused. Anthony, on the other hand, Anthony of Winterfell, where it's cold, is looking at Game of Thrones from a production standpoint. What are the visuals? How is it directed? Tell us a little bit about that, Anthony.
Well, one of the things that I want to look at is not only the amazing locations that they're going to and that they're filming at, but also how they film it and what angles they're using, what special effects they're using, which luckily this episode we're going to talk about the first two episodes of the show, and there aren't a whole lot of special effects that went on in this one. Some minor stuff, but some of the locations are just amazing, and the whole production value of the show, that's one thing that sets the show apart, is they did not skimp on anything. It's top-notch all the way.
Well, I might argue except the titles. I'm disappointed in the titles, considering all the amazing title sequences I've seen from HBO shows.
Wait, you don't like the da-da-da-da-da-da-da?
You don't like the title sequence?
I think the video effects in the title sequence are disappointing compared to some of the amazing stuff that's out there now. Compared
to
Westworld.
Get off the podcast!
Westworld is amazing. That sequence is amazing. I wanted more. I wanted more.
Send your comments to feedback@letstalkaboutthrones.com.
Send your comments to Richard at...
So the first nearly spoiler thing that we're going to cover then, obviously, has to be that, Richard, when you're watching the episodes, you can't skip the visuals at the beginning. You have to watch it because there are clues about the episode every time that they show that title sequence.
Ooh, okay, that's good to know. I did not know that. I was not aware of that. So I will keep track of that.
Anytime they go to a new location, they will actually show that location somewhere in that sequence.
And can we talk about how amazing those titles are with all their little intricate jewel box things going on and doing? Richard, we have to have a talk.
I don't know. I feel like I saw this title sequence already in Tyrant.
Mm.
You're a good friend, and that's the only reason why we're still talking. Okay, so let's hold this thought. And I will
Wait a minute. What's your perspective?
Hold the thought. Because we haven't told anyone what I'm looking at it from. And I promise that when we get to the section of the show marked episode O the Day, we're going to talk about this in great detail.
Okay.
All right. I promise. It'll be the second thing we talk about. Anyway, just to say quickly, I, Jenny of Tarth, am going to try to, and I will fail, read each episode. I'll watch each episode again, and I will read the corresponding sections of the book. Now, in the beginning, in season one, this is going to be super easy, and it was actually for the first two episodes. It will become hilariously more difficult as the time goes on. So that's all I'm going to say about that.
All of these things are true.
All right. Anything else we want to say before we dive into the first ever episode of Game of Thrones?
No, I think we're good, because I'm really looking forward to listening to Richard's reaction, Sir Richard's reactions on how it starts out. Gosh, let's just go into the intro.
Yep. All right. Well, I think as we will establish precedent, we are always going to let the newbie go first, mostly so we can laugh. Okay, Richard, take it away. Give us from the opening of the show to say to the end of the titles. How about that?
Opening of the show to the end of the titles?
Yeah, the cold open of the show, right? So you watched episode one, and there was a very literal cold open.
Yeah,
right?
I was going to say, how is that a show, actually, I love it when a brand new show just starts with a cold open, and just, let's just jump into the story, let's not go through any title sequence, giving you any hints or anything else, just here's a cold open, boom, go,
it's
make it happen.
It's also a cold open.
Yeah.
I get it. We get it, Jenny.
No, I'm going to keep saying it. You guys, it's a cold open. I'm married to the king of repetition comedy. This is going to happen a lot. Okay, and then just to the end of the title sequences that you seem to decry with such ferocity. Okay, Richard.
I was impressed with it. No, I liked it. I love that it just started. It just dove right in. I thought that was amazing. I didn't expect that because it's the premiere episode. You figure that you're just going to start with the titles and then set things up. But no, instead, you start with this really strange scene where you're not quite sure exactly what happened. Turns out to be kind of horrifying. And then, boom, titles. And then you don't really have a clue what that had to do anything with when you actually start the show.
Right.
I mean, if there's anything Wire taught HBO, it was like, just do it and they'll figure it out eventually. That was my takeaway, is like, after The Wire, there was never again a show on HBO that felt it had to explain itself in the pilot.
Yeah, this is one of those things, this cold open, you jump in directly into the story and you're going at it. Not knowing anything about the history of the world, not knowing the political climate, not knowing why they're riding through a gate, through a huge wall into... I don't even know if you can see the wall, right? It didn't even show the wall initially.
It's a couple shots in. It takes a couple shots to show a small portion of the wall.
Right. And then, you know, they have bodies just laying on the ground, and you're not sure why they're there. It's just, there's so many why questions immediately going into the show.
It's also a horror movie. Like, let's just, like, the first 7 minutes of this are a horror movie, to the point where I'm like, I'm really glad I'm not alone right now watching this. Like, I couldn't even watch it the first time, and only now can I even get through it, because damn.
Yeah. Yeah, when the little girl pops up and, So it reminded me of so many Japanese horrors, that one little scene where she just looks over and her eyes are blue, and you as a viewer, you still don't know what's going on with it, but you know it's important. Like, there's only one color. There's black, white, and this bright blue in the entire first 7 minutes of the show, and it's like, okay, well, I got to key in on that.
Yep. Also, it's gross. Things are missing and red and when I first saw this, I was like, and I hadn't read the books when I first saw the TV show, I was like, I'm not gonna like this, and I like walked away nervously, and Matt was like, come back, it's my husband, the king of repetition comedy. So yeah, so I want to hear about the production standpoint, because like it's pretty intense, and also like
they use a lot of low angles, which one of the things about the low angle when you're watching cinema, a lot of times you're watching it from almost a three-quarter view, you know, above, you kind of get almost a god's eye view, or you're looking from below up at the characters. When you get at eye level view, it really involves you in the story. It puts you directly into the story. And it makes no qualms about the environment is massive, because first of all the visuals show this almost like a white mist that just goes on forever. There's no edge. There's no hard boundaries or anything else going through it. And then you start looking at the cinema of it, of going through the forest. There's no big chase scenes until the very end. Like the way that they film the scene, it kind of goes in nice and slow, and you kind of mysterious. There's no real talking about it until, well, something's happening, and they don't even show you what it is right off the bat. It's off the screen, and they split up, and it's just the way that they produce this section of it. It makes you feel like you're actually there.
Yeah, and I like one of the things I got from. So what I did was I watched the TV show at the same time as I read the book, because I had rewatched this series already prior to season 7. So this time I just sort of did a 2-screen experience, but one of those screens was the book. And this really interesting thing I noticed, which is basically you think based on the way the book goes, that the TV version of this cold open is very economical. A lot less words. It seems like a lot less passage of time. They're much closer to the wall. And yet they totally track like the first 10 pages. Now I'm reading it on Kindle, right? So they're weird pages. They're not quite, the pages aren't quite right. But the first 10 Kindle right. pages are the cold open. And the cold open goes on for like 7.5 minutes. So that really almost tracks to a minute a page. And what they're actually taking up the time with, instead of words, 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 are these incredible visuals. They are doing exactly what television is meant to do, which is tell a story through what you see and keep right. only the best of those incredible lines from the book.
And one thing that I noticed going from, you know, what I remember the books into the show, there were a few differences, very minor differences. Like instead of climbing the mound, he actually climbs a tree in the books, right? I think.
Yeah.
Little things like that. The stuff that they changed was so subtle that if you weren't specifically looking for it, you might miss it completely. And they built this ambiance during that entire time that the dialogue initially does in the book, that the overall scenery does in the show. We were spending a lot of time in this cold open.
I know, because it's a cold open. We'll breeze through episode one a little faster. But all right, Richard, it's time. There's a hard cut in both the literal and the what's happening on screens sense. And then we go into these opening Ouch. Titles, which you say you hate. Please explain.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. I kind of already gave my thoughts on this, but I feel like there wasn't a whole lot of anything original in the titles that I could detect. Now, the fact that you're saying that they actually give off clues, that's something that I need to watch more carefully. But the whole thing with the CGI mechanical gear and box nature of these things popping up, again, like I said before, I feel like I saw this already in Tyrant. Now, I get the Tyrant came after the premiere of this show, so maybe they actually stole some of their concept for their titles from this, but it just didn't wow me. I don't know why. I expected something more, I think, perhaps artistic. Perhaps this is too literal for me.
The original concept for the title sequence was to have a raven flying from city to city, because what they needed to do is they needed to establish distance. They needed to establish scale and placement, because there are people that are literally thousands of miles from each other in the first episode. You know, and time-wise, during the first episode, it's over a month passes in just that one episode. And you don't really realize it, because without looking, without watching the title sequence, you don't realize that King's Landing is literally 1,000 miles from Winterfell.
Yeah, I mean,
and then it's another couple hundred miles to the wall.
They always do subtle clues, but Richard, you should just get real comfortable with the fact that Game of Thrones is real loose with the passage of time. Like, just own it now. But you can see it in the direwolves getting bigger, right? So that's really your only clue. And then, like, you get some clues later. Okay, so basically what happens is this really great guy named Boromir, Eddard Ned Stark, is a really nice guy. He's got a bunch of really nice kids, most of which are like totally his and his wife's, one of whom isn't. They're living this happy life in the freezing place, right? And then you get about like 5 minutes of things are going well, and then all hell breaks loose and continues to break loose for the next 100 episodes or whatever. Not even that many episodes.
It's 70. So the next 76.
We get 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes of just a nice view of these people.
What
lives.
Nice people these are.
Well, except for the bastard, because nobody likes him.
That's my knowing laugh.
Well, okay, so a few things about how they shoot this beginning part of Winterfell. First of all, they shot it in a parking lot. Everything was in a mall parking lot, and they just covered up all the stores with all the walls and things like that that you see of Winterfell are actually frontages in place to cover the store fronts.
Oh, dude, you are ruining it for me. You're spoiling the magic.
But they only had a limited space, and what they did is they used every angle of the scenes that they built, and it really shows you how big Winterfell is, even though it's tiny. Actuality.
Did a great job.
And I really like the fact that this first 10 minutes, it establishes the Stark family as kind of the center characters of the story.
Yeah.
And that will continue on, even though some of the Starks don't. And it gets really, at some points you start to wonder, is it really...
Spoilers?
That's one. I'm going to keep a spoiler count. Hold on. Where's my pen? Every time we spoil Richard just a little. So let that be known. Episode one, spoiler number one.
A soft spoiler, though. That was very soft.
They're all going to be soft. They're going to be soft-boiled egg spoilers.
But it really establishes the Starks as the center family, and the fact that the king is coming to the Starks and not the other way around, at least in the ethos of the story, helps establish that as well.
Yeah, and yeah, also you've really got Ned point. Being all nice, even though he's chopping off somebody's head. You've got him, listening and agreeing to take in these dire wolves. Like, we can't go through every single thing that happens in here. We'll be here for 75 hours, but like... they are trusting your previously held Sean Bean awe to establish this character. It's like if what Boromir had a nice dad, this is what he would have been. This is, of course, Boromir from the movie adaptation of The Lord of the Rings, who I will refer to incessantly because I like those movies. But you've got, you're basically your fairly traditional medieval-ish, British-ish stuff going on, and it's all, by the way, tracking pretty faithfully with the book. They make one little interesting change, which I really like, which is they stick with Westeros, which is the name of this giant continent, right up until King Robert the Fat, Robert Baratheon, starts worrying about this little girl and her brother who live across the sea. And that's when I think things get really different. Right? Like, we are entirely in, like, medieval paradigm for the first, 20 minutes of the episode, and then all of a sudden it's something, like, far more exotic. What do you think, Richard?
Well, if you consider a brother, presumably a prince, stooping his sister on screen, then yeah, far more exotic. I guess it didn't start that way, but the interaction that they had between each other, at least I should say the liberties that he took,
there's a little bit of fondling,
the way that he interacted
heavy
with her,
fondling
suggested Yeah, suggested a little bit more was going on there than one might expect. But hey, this is HBO, so within like just a couple minutes, we get breasts and incest right there, no problem. And I guess I should just get used to that because that's going to be
thematic.
I'm pretty sure from what I saw in just that first episode that we're going to see a bunch of that.
Well, one of the things was if you watch that scene, knowing how things are going to go out, Viserys really treats Daenerys as property. He's actually it's not a sexual attraction. It's more of a evaluation of livestock. Yeah. You know, but
that is his sister, right?
Yes, and that continues throughout their story together. That he is constantly he sees her as property,
a bargaining chip.
As something exactly something for him to barter.
You know,
away.
And as a lady, I'm totally cool with that and had no props with it whatsoever the first time I saw it.
I'm sure
it was fine. You know, I didn't mind. It was okay.
So,
yeah.
Immediately after that scene, you know, they talk about Drogo is, you know, he's coming and you have to be impressive and this is your one shot to make me proud, sister, and that kind of stuff. Then they cut to go back to Winterfell. And one of the things that I wanted to note on here, I specifically wrote it down, was there's a moment where Arya runs into the formation when the king and everybody else is coming into Winterfell. And Arya looks at the Hound, and he's got his big helmet on, his big dog helmet, and it cuts back to her, and she's almost in admiration of him.
Oh, I didn't
and
notice that.
There's a certain little part of it, and you know, knowing in the future how things turn out for certain people, that one look right there kind of changed a certain dynamic of their relationship once they actually start talking.
Yeah, and other things, Richard, that certain, there are a lot of things that will become important later. Like the first time I rewatched this episode, I was just struck by a number of things, which is, and I won't say who, but how many characters never see each other again after this first episode?
Right.
How many characters talk to each other in this episode in which those conversations will be important? I'm not even kidding you. 7 seasons later. And it's just...
Well, and that's just awesome storytelling.
It's just so great because it's fun in and of itself to watch certain people talk to each other with, you know, callous disregard or brutal honesty or what caring or whatever it is. But, man, will that come back later? And it's just like a joy to watch.
It really is.
That's cool.
Especially once we get into the next episode, episode 2, there's not a scene in episode 2 that doesn't foreshadow a major event in the story.
Wait, so we're not there yet, right?
No, not yet.
Need to be time-wise, but we're not there yet.
All right, so let's just wrap up this episode by saying you've got stuff happening in the West, stuff happening in the East, and sort of like the foreign East. You've got, I think, what could only be described as an absolutely stunning number of characters introduced. I mean, like, could you name a single one, Richard, if you really had to right now?
So the only person that I can really name is Tyrion.
Okay.
Okay.
That's who stuck out for you.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of people who did. I wrote some names down. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce them right. We didn't even mention, like, you know, there's the evil brother and sister, and then there's the handsome brother and sister who you want to believe aren't evil because, you know, they look good. And so, you know, they're a part of presumably this royal family, and we didn't really find out a whole lot about them, but apparently they like to have sex with each other too.
Yes. Woe is me if I skip that part.
You know, that's a thing.
So like, you know, when you ride 1,000 miles north to your husband's buddy's house, the first thing you're definitely going to do is sneak up to a tower and bork your brother.
Yeah.
Like that seems totally reasonable to me as a member of present day society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one more thing, remind me, the wedding to Drogo was not in this episode, was it?
No.
That's in the beginning.
That's in the next one.
This time he just comes up, he evaluates her essentially, and then rides away. And it's left to say, well, did he approve? You know, Viserys is asking, did he approve?
Because if he didn't, they wouldn't be there anymore.
Right, exactly. And by the way, that whole scene was shot in a real palace in Spain.
Cool.
It's an actual place you can visit. It's one of the many.
Nice. So one more thing I want to mention before we leave here. One of the opening scenes, in fact, I think it was the opening scene after the titles, was the boy climbing up the building, or maybe he was climbing down after seeing the guys that were coming in after seeing the evil force.
Yeah.
Like they were coming toward the village, and he goes climbing down and everything, and his mother catches him and says, "I don't want you climbing again." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, "Oh, that's got to be foreshadowing."
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? And so sure enough, before even the end of the episode, the brother and sister, Cersei, is that how you pronounce his name?
Her.
Cersei? Right? The sister?
Cersei
Lannister? Yeah.
Cersei.
So Cersei is the woman and Jamie?
Jamie.
Yeah.
Yep.
Jamie's the man.
Jamie?
Yep.
Is the man. Okay, so Jamie ends up basically like pushing him off. And so the episode ends and you're like, oh shit, he's dead.
And now that's actually a point they pushed on it a little harder in the books, I believe. To my memory, she mentions it to him like three times before that actually happens.
Yeah, and in the books, it's really interesting the amount of time they take and how much more efficiently television does it. And you got to give it to the showrunners of this show. They are good translators. Mm. I give them a lot of credit for all the guff they're going to take later for a bunch of things.
Yeah.
Like, they get a lot of credit for effortlessly slicing and dicing a lot of information into something that might even possibly be understandable to a first-time viewer. I mean, there's just a lot going on. Like, you got two people in a crypt reliving their entire history from like the moment that they were fostered by the guy who's dead, and one of them was almost going to marry the sister of one of them, but then she died and he wanted to kill the guy who absconded with her instead, and he dreams about killing her every night. This is all in like one scene.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, okay. And it's funny, in the book, I won't go into it, but boy, are they so much more detailed about certain levels of foreshadowing involving the color of people's hair, the color of people's eyes, the names of people, what they look like. And it's really quite stunning, because really in the book, you're even, if you're reading the book for the first time, you're even more lost than if you were watching the TV show for the first time. They're just like, the first chapter is like 1,000 names.
This episode is a great litmus test for the show. Like, if you can't halfway keep up with this episode, you are not mentally prepared for the rest of the show.
Yeah. Like, that is correct.
Well, I mean, I did feel like there was a lot going on, but I just had to go with it, right? I mean, I just felt like, you know what? I'm not going to catch it all now. Eventually, I'll trust that they'll properly introduce me to these people so that I better understand what's going on.
And I'll tell you that I've seen the first episode probably 3 times, and this is the first time that I noticed certain things, because this is the first time I watched it critically, when I was actually trying to really pay attention to the small details so we could talk about it on this show. And I learned things on my 4th viewing that I'd never caught during the first 3. There's so much packed into this episode.
Oh man, it's really amazing.
All right, and I have to mention my favorite scene. It's a scene where Ned has made the decision internally to go and be the King's Hand and go down to King's Landing. And Maester Luwin and Catelyn are behind him. They're all facing the camera, and Ned is in the middle, and Maester Luwin is on one side, and Catelyn is on the other side, like they're the good devil, or the angel and the devil on his shoulders. And the way the scene is framed is just beautiful. And it repeats like 3 more times throughout the series, where you have a central character, and then on either side of them in the background, over their shoulder, are the good and the bad. ideas behind it.
That's really amazing because I remember that happening now that you say it. And I thought it was interesting that he was getting different perspectives in each ear, but it didn't occur to me exactly what that was referencing. That's brilliant. Mm.
Who do you think, Richard, is the most important character in this first episode?
Oh, yes. Good question.
Ooh. Wow.
If you had to pick a central character.
I want to say Jon Snow because he seems like the outcast. And I think in most good stories, the outcast ends up being way more important than most people might expect.
Mm.
Perceptive. All right, good. Now, Anthony, who, knowing everything that you do, who to you in this episode is the most important or memorable after a rewatch of knowing the whole season?
Mm.
And I don't think it's spoilery. I just think it's like, who do you stands out with all that you know now?
I didn't expect you to ask me that particular question.
I know. That's why it's a good question.
Damn media people. For whatever reason, even in the first time I watched the show and as I was reading the books and everything else, the one character that always stood out at me that was always just different enough that I knew they were special. I just didn't know how special they were until things, you know, developed, is Arya.
Yeah.
She's always been like, there's no hint of her having any kind of special powers or anything stupid like that. It's just something about the way the character's played, the way it's portrayed in the books, and just how, when she's on scene, she's the center of that scene every single time.
Yep.
Something about that, something about Arya just always strikes me like that.
All the people that we are sort of led to believe are the moral stand-ups love her. And that's evident just from a watching of this episode. So, all right. So we could still talk about this forever, and we probably will refer back to it. But for now, let us cross the river on the bridge that Hoster Tully has let us cross and go over to episode 2.
Oh, okay. So episode 2, the first thing you find out, if I remember correctly, is that Bran didn't die.
Right. Wait, he survived?
Well, he's not
watched
dead.
Watched episode 2, right?
Right, but that was my first reaction. Oh. Was he survived?
Yeah. Yeah, and you don't know what state he's in. He's in a coma, assumedly, and it's kind of the whole demeanor of Winterfell as a whole changed. It's now this dour construct, and Winterfell itself. If you notice the differences between episode one, episode two, in episode one, Winterfell, the land is still green, it's still vibrant, it's cold. Everybody's wearing furs, but it's cold, but it's vibrant, it's green. And the difference between that and episode 2, if you watch them back to back, episode 2 is noticeably snowier. It's mm-hmm. noticeably colder. And I think that really sets the tone just from you seeing the Bran. You know, you're left with at the end of the first episode with Bran just kind of fallen and just, okay, well, that's that.
Yeah, and again, this episode is just insanely noticeable, even more so than the first one. For the partings of people who will never see each other again.
Right. Or who will meet, because some people are, some people part ways and others team up, like, yeah. You know, and they go together in certain places, but knowing later on just the foreshadowing of this episode, every scene in this episode is foreshadowing major events later on.
Okay, so basically, am I correct in saying, and I'm looking at a recap here, I'm not going to lie, GameofThronesWikia.com, which we're going to be looking at a lot. This scene does actually start across the sea in Essos, right? I think.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
So basically, you've got this guy, this old 40-year-old guy, friend of the family named Jorah Mormont, and he is the one person who's nice to Daenerys Targaryen, who's having a little trouble with her saddle.
I actually took a note last time in the last episode that Viserys is noticeably threatened by Jorah Mormont's presence when he comes up and presents his gifts of books to her for the wedding.
Yeah, because this young lady has never been allowed to be independent and has always been under her brother's don't wake the dragon bullshit thumb. And Jorah represents some sort of like, you know, friend of your father who's kind of hot and seems nice to you.
Well, he represents the old world because he's from Winterfell, actually.
Yeah. No, he's from Bear Island.
Which is
part of the Winterfell. North. Okay, I'll give you that. Yeah. He's from the North. It's fine.
He may not be from the city of Winterfell, but he's from the land of Winterfell.
He represents good in this in the limited narrow space of the world we have been taught. Jorah comes from the place that we have seen most of the quote good people come from.
Right.
So,
and to top it all off, he brings books.
Yeah. Then now Richard, we're back in Winterfell, right? We're watching all of these people freak out about poor Bran, and you've got this scene with the prince Joffrey. What's your take on our friend Joffrey here?
I'm trying to remember who Joffrey
is. Well, that's a good start. He's blonde and a little bit pouty. He's the prince who will be king of the whole place at some point.
He's crown prince.
Oh. What? You know, it's funny. I didn't even put him in my notes because he just strikes me as an obnoxious, spoiled brat who obviously has gotten everything that he wants and has no clue about what real life is. And I just love how when for a moment he's put at a disadvantage, he becomes a crying baby.
Yeah. And really, like, I think we've already gone too long in this episode without talking about how amazing from the very start Peter Dinklage is as Tyrion Lannister and how much he commands the space of the chaotic neutral force, right? Like, well educated, but beholden to his family, but not really, but also just the smartest guy in the room and the best actor, really, if you think about it. Like, boy, he is just like in that role from the beginning. And I remember back when the show first premiered, like, I don't know, everybody was talking about the boobs and the incest, but they were also talking about Peter Dinklage and what a revelation he was in this role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing that's amazing there is, like, he plays this character so well because you feel like, and it seems like the natural reaction, that you should kind of not like him because he's a playboy and he's irresponsible while everybody else is trying to, you know, be with the family and comfort them and everything. And it turns out that he probably has the better world perspective on everything and is in many ways more genuine than anyone else that you've seen so far. At least that's how he's portrayed right now. And I think that's amazing. And I also love that, like, he comes from this place where, look, I know what it's like to be put down. You know, I've had to overcome that my entire life. And he's stronger as a result of that. So he's by far the person or the character that I like the most in the two episodes that I've watched.
One of the things that really gets me about Tyrion is you have the Meisters, these people that study their entire lives to learn the secrets of the known world and some of the secrets of the unknown world, and they gather all this knowledge, and it's not only their occupation, but it's what they dedicate their lives to. And then you have Tyrion, who actually reads and acquires knowledge for fun and entertainment and to use it for his own gain. Where, and it's not,
which almost no one else in the whole country has the time to do.
Right. It's like this complete, he just happens to be in the right place at the right time with the right ailment that allows him this luxury of learning at will.
Yeah.
And it's in such stark contrast to the Citadel and the Meisters and this knowledge, this library knowledge that you know shares out.
So basically, like, there's a lot of goodbyes, right? And they're all sad, and they're sad in retrospect, and they're kind of sad in the moment, and it's like scene after scene of goodbyes. But the most important goodbye is when Ned Stark says goodbye to Jon Snow. And Jon asks one more time, like, who's my mom? Is she alive? Does she know I'm going to the wall? Does she care about me? And Ned Stark says, I'll tell you next time.
Yeah. And again, the foreshadowing that sets up an amazing scene later on in this season, actually, where you realize the gravity of everything being said. And that, just that little scene, that little cutaway where they go separate ways.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So, you know, note that for later, Richard.
Yeah.
I also think, I mean, they made an unsurprising big deal about him choosing to leave his wife to go to wherever it is they're going. And she's obviously not happy about it, but acknowledges that, you know, kind of against her will, that, okay, he's resigned to doing this. And whether that's as big a separation or not, as far as the future of the story goes, I don't know. But it seemed like they made a big deal about that, and it didn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually more surprised at her reaction to, Catelyn's reaction to Jon Snow when Jon came to say goodbye to Bran. And that, like, you even reading the books, you knew there was some tension there, and you knew there's a backstory and everything else. It just seemed almost out of character for Catelyn, knowing how her story develops as well. You know, it's just,
it's, man, the one time that, she's mean.
Harsh. Yeah, exactly, and she's really, really mean.
Yeah,
and that came out of left field for me. Like, I don't really understand enough to know why that happened.
Well, last time Ned left, he came back with a son, and then that son comes in as she has a son dying in a bed. So I can understand how that, you know, the eruption of emotion and how that's kind of all coalescing at one place, but it's just so out of character for her.
Yeah.
By
the way, this is what, a month after the episode started?
Yeah.
Roughly?
Yeah, well, yeah, because she's, when Ned actually leaves, Catelyn says it's only been a month since he's been laying here or whatever, and they're like, well, you know, it might be time to start letting him go, and she said, well, she was talking to Rob, she said, I'll wait. You know, it's only been a month or whatever. So,
but it's only been a month that he's been lying here with no sustenance whatsoever because he's in a coma. Can I remind people that a human cannot live for a month without water?
They actually cover that in the books.
No, I don't remember that.
Jenny?
What did they say? I must have been reading fast.
Meister Lewin goes in there with honey drops and water and, like, these basic necessities. It's just one little blurb in there, but I think he comes in so that Catelyn can leave, and he's gonna feed Bran at the same time. And he had the honey drops and whatever.
Yeah, especially you could just,
and so
you could
what
put a thing down his throat. We're getting off topic. You could keep him alive, and also maybe he's special.
He might be special. I don't know, because, you know, he did that thing where he woke up when something happened to one of the wolves.
So since you mentioned it,
that could be.
I just want to say it's really, first episode ends with Bran dying. Of course, I mean, because you don't know he survived. Bran dies at the end of the first episode. Another Stark, Lady Stark, the dog, dies at the end of the second episode. Like, it's developing a trend of these Starks dying very quickly. Now, Bran wakes back up, and Lady has her own story. But, you know, it starts these things. They're like, whoa, what is going on?
Yeah, they're establishing real quick that ain't nobody safe. Dogs, direwolves.
The other thing that I just want to say is I think the relationship they have with the wolves is very interesting. I don't know how far they go with that, but they establish in this episode very clearly that they have a very tight relationship, and that the wolves have some sort of kind of empathic relationship with the humans. And while they won't act on command, as they demonstrate, they will jump without hesitation to defend the humans.
Right. And that really starts with the assassination attempt on Bran. That scene going into that, when Rob's in there in the tower and he's talking about, oh, there's a fire, and you know, because she's Catelyn's pissed off because the dogs won't stop barking and this and that. Rob looks out the window, says it's a fire, and he goes off. That scene with the assassin coming in and trying to kill Bran and trying to kill Catelyn as well in the mm-hmm. sidelines or whatever, really took me by surprise. And that cemented to me that, hey, there's something, like, he didn't just, this wasn't just one person. Like, there's a major force on the other side of the Starks that's opposing the Starks. Maybe it's Jaime and Cersei. Maybe it's something more, but something's definitely there.
I assumed it was Jaime and Cersei.
I like to call this episode Catelyn Stark, Ace Detective, because she's just like on it. She's got the forensics. She assembles a team, you know, of prosecutors. Like, she makes a plan. Like, this lady is no joke. She is really the moral center of this episode for sure. And she's in charge. Like, she starts it very weak, and then her mommy protectiveness is roused, and she focuses up. And I really like it as a choice, right? And of George R. R. Martin's. And then on the other hand, you've got, like, it's such an interesting contrast between these two women, because you've got strong and homely Catelyn Stark. I'm not saying she's homely, but I'm saying, like, you know, like, she is, like, in the hell charge. And then you've got Daenerys on the other side of the world, who's being, you know,
raped by her husband,
deflowered in the wide open, being attended to by her handmaids, and who all know more than she does about dragons, which is insane. Basically just, you know, getting run through in every way possible. And it's a really smart contrast, I guess, is what I would say.
Mm. And that kind of continues for a while too. Mm-hmm. As their lives kind of shift as the story goes along, in sync with each other.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that until you just mentioned
it. I didn't realize it until I just mentioned
it. That's really interesting.
It's one of those amazing things that you're just like, hey, wait, no, wait a second. I guess
I like that. Yeah. Well, and I want to take that one step further, because while you say that, you know, Catelyn takes kind of control and moves forward and starts, like, you know, doing her thing, I kind of feel like that's the same for the other woman too.
Daenerys.
This was the episode where she, after talking with the maidens or whatever they are, that she decided, all right, I'm going to take control of the situation. I'm going to use what I have available to me to basically take over and be in control of the situation. And I had a lot of respect for that. I thought that was actually a really cool twist.
That is a fair and excellent point. It's just hard because she starts at a point of greater disadvantage. But you're right, she is absolutely, the moment she's married to Drogo, she's essentially out from under her douchebag brother's thumb, and she's making very small steps in the direction of taking control of her life.
And not to mention,
she once will be equal with Aquaman. Oh, I mean Drogo.
And don't forget that when she turns the tide on Drogo when they're in bed that night, she's literally risking her life to make that stand and to make that jump. And it's not a small feat.
Yeah. I mean, Daenerys's arc, we could have a conversation later, like at the end of season one, we can have a conversation about who's arced the most in this season alone, and I'm definitely obviously gonna nominate Daenerys Targaryen just on these two episodes alone. So she's an impressive character.
Okay, and my non-spoilery spoiler for the episode. This is the episode where Arya's list begins.
Mm.
This is when the first name hits her list, and it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's, yeah. Knowing how that comes out, it's especially yeah. It, man, that was such a when that hit me. Like I got chills. I was like, oh, that's where it starts. Right there. That's where the list starts.
It's a real advantage in having what at that point 4 or 5 books worth of. Ahead, you know, future knowledge to play on because yeah. Wow, they are.
But they play it. Maisie Williams plays the part, and you can see yep. it in her character's face. Even though at that time one of the books hadn't even been released, right? I mean, she is. Oh my, yeah. Just the actors. Can we just mention the other actors real quick? Like Maisie Williams playing Arya. Like she's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love, I mean, I hate all the little whiny brats, which at this point would include Sansa and Joffrey and, mm-hmm. you know, in some senses, Cersei, before you really get a deeper glimpse into her character. She's pretty much just always bitching about something or another. And the scene...
How can you hate Sarah Connor?
I know.
Come on.
She's a bad bitch. Remember that episode of the Sarah Connor Chronicles? Matt and I made fun of that for years. But it is a hard bunch of scenes to watch there at the crossroads because your sense of justice, which has been so primed in episodes 1 and the first half of this episode with the Starks, like you are firmly rooted in Winterfellian justice, and the second mm-hmm. they get on the road, it's like, good luck, bye bye wolves.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, the crossroads, the inn at the crossroads, mm-hmm. reappears in the TV show. It appears more in the books, but it reappears in the TV show at least 5 times that I can remember offhand, to include the first episode of the 7th season.
Yeah.
Like that one location, it's constantly reused. Like it's the literal center of Westeros. Yeah.
And, you know, bad things happen to the wolves, which sucks because they don't deserve it. And it's Ned Stark's first indication that if it's this bad on the road, wait till he gets to King's Landing. I mean, it's really like
right.
you can see like one. It's just sad. It makes me sad.
This is the first time he questions his honor and his vow, and that only increases as things go along.
Yeah, and you know what? Bran's awake. What can you say?
Right. How was that for you, Richard, when you saw the cutscene from Lady getting her little throat slit to Bran waking up?
That was actually a really hard scene for me. I looked away when he dove the blade in, and then they cut to cut to Bran's room, and the other wolf is the first thing that you see, and you feel like there's going to be a connection there, but in fact, no, the connection is somehow perhaps with Bran, and I think that was really cool. I liked that a lot.
Yeah, I like how they allude to it, but they didn't actually, like, even to this day, it's still not defined. So they definitely didn't give you too much at that point.
Anyway, we could have talked about any number of different scenes in this episode, but really, the key point is once you're out of Winterfell, you watch out. In the future of these shows, we will be taking your emails and tweets and some such as soon as we get an email address. So hold this place here and let us know what you think of the show, of the Game of Thrones, of the books, where you are on the spectrum of knowledge when it comes to Westeros and Essos and the Song of Ice and Fire. And you know what? Thanks for gutting it out with us. That's Richard of River Run. Sir Anthony of Winterfell, and me, Jenny of Tarth.
More Thrones, please.
More Thrones.